So the subject for tonight is this body-mind as a field for liberation. I think many of us would feel that the word liberation is completely unnecessary for us and irrelevant, because we sit, mind our own business, quiet as a mouse, and up comes restlessness and boredom and pains in the body and stress and million thoughts, most of which are totally irrelevant and unimportant. And this body-mind doesn't look like a field for liberation. It looks like a big mess. And and not all, because what often can happen is that it develops from there to emotions, anger, anxiety, and realize life is not a piece of cake. We do sit here quietly and we begin to realize that there is a lot of difficulty in this body-mind. And that the first noble truth of the Buddha, which is that there is pain and suffering in the experience of embodied beings, namely all beings that are born in a body, whether it's an ant or a human being, it makes no difference. That there is suffering and pain in the fact of being born into a body. Doesn't mean to say life is suffering and pain. It means our experience of life has in it suffering and pain, which is unavoidable, plus all the other things too. Pleasure and joy and peace and all the other things are there. But we can't just have the other things and wipe out the difficulty. And I think that that's what happens when we sit, is we do feel that, because a large part of our life is spent trying to avoid it. And no suffering is more clear than the suffering of trying to avoid suffering. Being busy, which is actually a very Western way of avoiding suffering. Being so busy that you can't notice that you're suffering. It's like a rechev shetach, that is a kind of jeep that goes so fast over a rough road, it doesn't even notice that there's holes. Because it's just going whoosh, and so everyone feels fine. But actually there's big holes, but it's going so fast that it can't notice them. And we have the suffering written into our body-mind. We have it as scars, tzalakot. And I sometimes think, for example, the Shoah, the Holocaust, is like a huge scar. And we do everything going around it and around it and around it. We do all kinds of things because of it. And we don't really look at the scar, but we just allow the scar to be there and then live a life of kind of national anxiety and project it onto other people and so on. And really what's moving this is the scar, the tzaleket. And we have many, many of these things in us, and the difficulties and the pains do tend to come up when we stop long enough and clearly enough and quietly enough to give space. And that's what we're doing here. We're actually giving space. And we give space, one of the best ways of giving space is by concentration. And so when we concentrate on the breath, we're not just creating calmness. we're actually creating opportunity for the truth of what's written into this body-mind to emerge. We're allowing the truth to emerge by simply not covering it up with thinking, doing, acting, and functioning. So it's a valuable thing to just stop, but more than that, to concentrate, to be quiet, and to have a focus which is in the body-mind, because it does give space for things to come up. So it's very important, two kind of rules of the game, put it like that. One is that suffering is not personal. And anybody, we all feel, we all take it on ourselves, that, oh, why have I got this boredom, this mishamemli, and it's a problem, and I can't meditate, and it's me, and I'm no good at this, and everyone else is so much better at this, and I'm the one that doesn't work, this whole thing doesn't work for me, and I better go home, and everyone else is already the Buddha, and I'm just sitting here bored and restless and fed up. No, wait a minute. Look at it more carefully. Boredom and restlessness is coming up, mostly in our life, we never let it. As soon as we have a little bit of boredom and restlessness, we go and see a movie, turn on the TV, take a drink, we don't let it come up. So it's not ours, it's in the nature of the lived experience for things to happen that make us suffer. And so we don't need to take it all personally. Suffering is in the nature of, so everyone's individual form of difficulty will be their individual form. It's like Eckhart Tolle wrote a book called The New World, I think it is. And in there, quite a big proportion of the book is about what he called the pain body. Which he said, you know, we build a pain body in our life. All the makot we've got, and all the shouting that we've got, and all the frustration that we have as a child when we want to play and someone says no, we have to sit in school, and all the frustration from all our life and all the tears are kind of built into a pain body. The way the pain body looks is like our personality. It has us written on it. But everyone's got one. And so it's kind of written into our biography is all the disappointments and all the difficulties, and the pain body is there. And it's not ours. And secondly, it's not that we can't meditate just because we've got these things coming up. These things are the place of our practice. That's exactly why we practice, is to allow the scars to be seen, to allow the things that we've buried to arise and to be revealed. It's not the only way, reason we practice. We also practice for calmness and for joy and for being fresh like a child and going out into the walking meditation and seeing the tree as if it's for the first time that we ever saw the tree. This is also why we meditate. But partly it is to meet the things we buried and the things written in to our mind-body that we'd rather not see. So anyone experiencing difficulty, it's not that the meditation is failing, it's the meditation is succeeding. It means you are doing the job, things are coming up, and we need to deal with these things, we need to work with them. And the truth is, we can't deal with the stuff in our biography just by thinking about it. It isn't enough. I know that many of us, many of you, are helped by working psychologically. And I don't want to put it down at all. It's extremely valuable. The right place, the right time, the right person. Psychological work important and valuable. But there is a limit to the way we can think our way out of problems. You know, latzet mi bayot shehem betoch machshavot al yedei machshavot. The problems are sitting in the consciousness and we try and think them away. And we still find that we're there. Especially deep existential problems. Because they're in a place which is not, the thought doesn't have the power to undo some very basic things in us, to heal the scars that we have in our soul. Einstein said, you can't solve problems with the same mind that created them. The mind creates problems, we need to find another place to deal with them. And so we come to the word vipassana. And vipassana is to see clearly. That's the translation of vipassana. Vipassana is not the name of a technique, although it's become that. But the actual word means to see clearly. And it's arrived indeed from 2,500 years of development in the Buddhist world of ways of actually dealing with this issue of how do we transcend suffering and find our liberation. How do we work with suffering which is not just thinking about it and worrying about it and hoping we can get over it or praying to for the Mashiach to come and get us out of it? How do we really get out of it? The source of vipassana is the monastic community in the East, especially Thailand and Burma. And it's come out of the monasteries into the West about 60 years ago, 50 years ago. And just a small point, besograim, meditation and vipassana hasn't necessarily been the main practice in the Buddhist world in the East. The Buddhist world in the East, there were hundreds of years in which meditation wasn't important. Instead, chanting the texts, doing rituals, nidivut or generosity, and qualities of being have often been more important than meditation. But meditation became very important because in the Western world there was obvious need for something direct, personal, individual that you and I can do that doesn't need a priest and doesn't need a religion, and it can be right there in the high street of Tel Aviv or London for everybody. And it's a deep practice, a transforming practice. So it really fitted the need of the Western world at this time, historical time. But it's only this time. It hasn't been in the West only 50 years, and in the East, very much limited use of meditation. And so it provides a systematic way of practice, well developed, well constructed, but actually very open. Not some teachers and some monasteries will be very, very exact about the practice. Some will be not exact. We are not exact here. We're not telling you exactly what you have to experience and where exactly in this moment what exactly you have to look at. There is a much more a sense of openness in the way we do things here in this tradition. But you'll find all kinds of traditions, and each one has its qualities and it's something to give. And I did many, 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 many retreats, for example, with Goenka. And Goenka's, my main teacher for the first, I don't know what, 15 retreats that I did, 10-day retreats, was Mother Sayama, who was with Goenka in Burma. And she has a center in England. And I used to go there 3 times a year for a 10-day retreat, all through the 80s. And it's very exact. And very much, those of you who've been there know this. And it has its real power and its advantages. But we choose a more open way of doing things for reasons that I don't want to go into right now. It needs another whole talk. But Vipassana is built on an element that you may have heard Yonatan speak about yesterday, which in the Pali is the Pali word sampajana. And sampajana goes with sati. Sati is mindfulness, and sampajana is clear understanding of what it is we see. And so clear understanding is not just mindfulness, that we are like watchful, like someone playing basketball will have to be very mindful to see where the ball is at every minute. But we're doing something a bit extra than that. It's not just that we are mindful, like you could say a soldier has to be very mindful when a soldier is on watching on guard all night. Very mindful. So therefore, is he a Buddhist? Is he advanced meditator from sitting all night? I don't know, maybe. But there is other elements to mindfulness, as Yonatan said. And one of them, sampajana, is a clarity about what it is that we see. An understanding of the nature of what it is that we see. And one of the things that the nature of what it is we see is that everything has a beginning, a middle, and an end. One breath has a beginning and a middle and an end. One step has a beginning and a middle and an end. And if we look more carefully, one raising of the foot has a beginning and a middle and an end. And if we look more carefully, each moment is actually arising and disappearing. More or less, as soon as it arrives, it disappears again. So there's a clarity there about the way things are moving, and also the way things are somehow doing it themselves. We're not entirely in charge of everything. Things are happening. Vipassana is about that deepening that understanding and that clarity that's in mindfulness itself. Ability to watch things as they arise and pass by. So vipassana is the tovana, tovanot, we arrive at, we get, when we watch things arising and passing away. Tovanot are, wow, this life is dynamic. You may have a story. You may have a story that's painful, like judgment, shiputyut. And you can judge yourself. I'm no good. I don't think I can do this. I'm not a successful person. People criticize me. They put me down. You know, we can have judgmental thoughts. I should be better. I must achieve. I must be a millionaire. Whatever. Million of those kind of thoughts, on and on and on and on. If we look at that with the eye of vipassana, we see firstly that it is just thought. It isn't truth. Because we're looking with mindfulness at something, it arises and passes away. It has a beginning and a middle and an end. It's just a thought that arises, is there, stays a bit, and goes. There may be a reaction. Oh, I'm no good. Maybe we really take it inside. But that too, that response, that tguva, beginning, a middle, and an end. So these things, which we think are truth or fact, Fact, I'm no good. No, it's not a fact. It's a thought which is arising, staying for a moment, going away. It's not a fact. It's not truth. The truth is that it's a thought that arises and stays and goes away. That's the truth of it. So if we look more, Vipassana shows us that life is consisting of moments and that we make from their constructions, and that there's something there, that we are not these things. We are bigger than these things. We are the container of these things. We think we are no good. No, we contain thoughts that say that we're no good. Or we contain thoughts, but we also contain pain, and we also contain, we are a big container of all that stuff, all the constructions. We're much bigger than we think we are. We are not defined by these things. And that's insight that Vipassana can help us. There's a Sufi story that I like to tell, that you may have heard it from me before, about a man that wanted to go to, who was found himself in prison, and he wanted to get out of prison. So he wrote to his friend and said, "Send me a screwdriver, a hammer. I want to break the lock and get out of this prison." He got a parcel, and there was no screwdriver and no hammer in there. He was very disappointed. All it was a prayer carpet. He was Muslim. They got a prayer carpet. Well, he didn't like to pray, so he threw it in the corner of the cell and got angry. And he just walked up and down for a couple of weeks, getting very frustrated. And then one day he said, "Well, I might as well pray. I've got a prayer carpet. Maybe I'll pray to Allah. Maybe that will help me." So he, 5 times a day he prayed. After about 3 weeks praying 5 times a day, he found himself with his nose to the carpet in the middle of prayer. And for the first time, he looked carefully at the carpet. And he began to realize that woven into the carpet was the design of the lock that would set him free. It was woven in the tichnun, the itzuv, of the lock was written into the carpet. So like, we all want to break the lock and get free, but actually the freedom comes when we look carefully and we see the way things are made, what's going on. We look carefully, that's the freedom, because there we find, we look carefully at, oh, it's just a judgmental thought that comes and goes, then we're free. Might come again, okay, we do it again. Might come again, we do it again. Maybe 1,000 times, okay. But we're free once we know this is not me, this is just a thought, it's the shape of the lock, the design of the lock. So in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is perhaps a key text on which we base the Vipassana practice and the mindfulness practice, and by the way, Vipassana is not mentioned in the Satipatthana Sutta as a word. The truth is that Vipassana is not a word that you find so much in the Buddhist text. It is there, but it's not every page. But in the West, we took the concept Vipassana and the whole, we made it more of gave it a lot of weight. But in a way, it is about Vipassana, the basic text, the Satipatthana Sutta, on which we base this practice. And the Satipatthana Sutta is called the sutta means text, sati is mindfulness, and patthana is foundations or bases. So four bases of mindfulness, or four places of mindfulness. And these are basically the objects of meditation. Now, what we've been telling you up to now is a way of meditation and also objects of meditation. Objects meaning the breath is an object. Here is me, there is the breath, and I'm watching the breath, aware of or mindful of the breath. And so breath is in that place an object. So the four foundations are really four bases or four objects, and they're basically what the human being is made of. But it's cut into four pieces. The first is body. And this is largely what we've been doing up to now, which is the first foundation. First foundation doesn't mean that we stop doing it when we reach the second. It just means that it's a very good way to begin. But you will find meditators that have been practicing all their life, they will still practice with the body as well as with other things, other foundations. So the first foundation is the body, and meditation on the body means meditation, as we said before, on the bodiness of the body, the sense of embodiment, what it is like in this body, what this experience of body is like. Not what I want my body to be, what I think about my body, what I like about my body, what I think about the breath. No, it's the direct experience which doesn't need any intermediate, sochen is intermediary, agency, mitafchim. Doesn't need anything in between. It is just direct knowing. Doesn't need thinking, and it doesn't need mitafchim or any intermediate. It's straight. Knowing the breath, feeling the breath and me are happening. Just knowing it. It's a very direct knowing. And it's a powerful practice. I have a friend who practiced for years with the body, and he decided to practice on the experience of gravity, gravitatia, as his main practice. And he practiced a lot, constantly experiencing gravitatia, gravitation, as a force pulling him down, pulling him, the weight of it. And slowly, 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 he began to experience gravity as impersonal, not belonging to him, but something from the cosmos, something which it is, something working through him, but not his. And from that experience, he had huge change and awakening happening in his life. So in this story, the body is a window, and the window to the world, to the universe, if you like. And that's the way we can regard it. If we are connecting with the body, straightforward, straight, without thinking, without this, just knowing, fully knowing, it opens something for us. And of course, it also expands our consciousness. Harchava shalom modu shalom. And the reason is that mostly we forget what we don't really need. So we forget that we have a head unless we have a headache. And then as soon as we have a headache, we take an Akamol so we can forget it again. We forget we have a head unless we have a headache. We forget that we are walking unless we go to a retreat and someone says, do you know what it's like to walk? Oh, I forgot. I thought about it when I was 1 year old. Since then, I never thought about walking. I just walk. We forget our body. We've forgotten most of it. And all the thinking is happening here. And we withdrew all the intelligence, our awareness. We sort of pulled it out of the body into the mind, and that's where we look at the world, because I see the world, I see, you know. And what about all this? It's kind of forgotten. We lost it. Unless it hurts. So the body is a place to expand our consciousness, to awaken our consciousness. Just like the Sufi story. Places that we don't notice because they're subtle or under the radar, mitachat ha-radar. We're up here looking at, but we forgot what our feet and our hands and our breath and our blood, we forgot. So it opens our consciousness. Even though it might seem mamash tipshi, wow, I have to walk like a zombie. What's this? I taught a retreat for scientists 2 years running, last year and the year before. 60 scientists. And one of them did comment, it's a very strange practice, he said, especially walking in circles like zombie. I don't quite understand how that helping me understand my brain. But it was an interesting retreat. So I felt like Chief Zombie. So it might feel strange, but it does open the consciousness. And we can actually imagine how it helps us when we are walking in our ordinary life. We're standing in a bus and we feel our body. And we feel a touch of the ground. And we feel the world around us. And at that moment, our mind wakes up. And we are less locked in a thought, says, Matai autobus 25, Zurich lagia, ani chakiti po 20 dakot kvar. It's a different, totally different world. So the second foundation is feelings, liking, not liking, good for me, bad for me. And we experience it with disturbance, for example. Things that disturb us. The muezzin from the village here maybe disturbed us. We had a model called peace and silence. And all of a sudden, loudspeaker, strong. And we feel disturbed by it. Some of us maybe enjoyed it. Some of us maybe feel disturbed. Whatever. But the fact is that something disturbed us means we are disturbable by this. It's us, actually. It's not the thing that disturbs us. It's us that allow ourselves to be disturbed by that. The same decibelium of birds in the trees would not disturb us. Or the same decibelium of the bell calling us to lunch. Same decibel exactly, That won't disturb us. So it's not the sound that disturbs, it's us that disturb ourselves. Actually, we are disturbing the sound. Sound is doing nothing, it's just sound. We disturb the sound. Sound doesn't disturb us. Sound is okay, it's doing its thing. Sound is no problem, we disturb the sound. So, what disturbs us? What we like, what we don't like, what we want, what we don't want, what the taste of the food we enjoy, we don't enjoy. This suffering, it begins with feeling that I don't like this. I don't like to be bored. Liot shamemli, ani lo ohev et zeh. Zeh tchusha lo neima. That's Vedana, the second foundation. That we actually build the world according to like and not like. And there's no thought that doesn't have it. Every single thought and every single mental activity has in it some liking or not liking. And the biologists know this because, as I said to the group, if you look at the brain, thinking, any thought, it will always have emotional parts of the brain, even looking at a tree, or any neutral, it will be somewhere an emotional content will be there. So liking and not liking and neutral, which is not sure whether we like or we don't like, and all of that is happening all the time. I read somewhere a Zen dialogue. A student came to a Zen master and said, I feel hot and I'm shivering and then sweating. Tell me, the Buddha, would he also shiver and sweat like me? So the Zen master said, sure, the Buddha would just sweat and just shiver. So I'm the same as the Buddha. I sweat and I shiver. He said, no, you forgot the word just. Just is important. Just, in other words, that's it. Only shivering and only sweating. Just that. Not turning it into anything else. Just shivering is happening. Sweating is happening. That's it. Don't, no more than that. There is a poem, a Theravada poem that says, heat and I'm too hot, I'm too cold. In this way, our practice is finished. I'm too hot, I'm too cold. These can be like grasses that we pass by on the path. And we can just keep walking next to the grass and this thorn and this tree and sit down under a coconut tree and rest there. In other words, I'm too hot, I'm too cold. If we really believe it, I am disturbed, then my meditation is finished. Because we're just busy with that. But if we see, yeah, disturbance comes, goes, hot comes, goes, shivering comes, goes, sweating comes, goes. Yeah, it's not nice to sweat, not nice to shiver, but they're nothing. They're grasses. We pass by. So this understanding is meditating with Vedana. And it makes a big, big difference, especially with pain, because we spend all our life avoiding pain and trying to get pleasure. And if somehow we can get free of that prison of having to spend all our life busy with more pleasure and less pain, we open a huge freedom. And we're not a victim anymore. We're not busy anymore trying to get things better. We'll do what we need to do. We'll go to the doctor if we need to go to the doctor. We'll go to the hospital if we need to go to the hospital. But not spending our entire life busy with the whole issue of pain, pleasure, pain, pleasure. So that's Vedana, feelings. And feelings, when they get strong, become emotions. And we'll be talking more about emotions later on. So I don't want to talk too much about them now, about working with emotions. But basically, they are similar. They're much more powerful. That's all. They're not just liking or disliking. They have in them the body that recruit the magayes kola, adam, the body, the muscles, the stomach, all the changing motions of take over. They take over the whole system. Thoughts, memories, the heart, the energy of the blood. That's why the emotions are more difficult to deal with and powerful. But we do work with them in Vipassana as part of the second. They're the sort of between the second and the third foundation. We do work with them. It's very important to work with them. And we work with them by taking them to pieces. By not just taking the whole emotion and trying to deal with it and look at it as something coming and going, but part of it, like the stomach, just the stomach. So seeing anger in the stomach. Just taking it, the farek, this chavila called anger. And then we see that it comes and it goes like everything else. The third foundation is citta, mind, which is all the stuff passing through the mind, thoughts, impressions, states of mind. And when we have tiredness, cloudiness, or clarity, sharpness, or space, or dullness, or isheket in the mind, or sheket, quietness. All of these are mind. And the third foundation is looking at them with the mind. You say, wait a minute, stop. This is too much. How can you look at the mind with the mind? But of course you can. Because otherwise we wouldn't know we're thinking. We know we're thinking. What knows we're thinking? The mind. What's thinking? The mind. So it's one part of the mind looking at the other part. Okay, fine. No problem. And so our awareness of states of mind, like boredom and so on, is part of the practice. And it's very important. Because again, if we, with the eye of Vipassana, see that these are things, states of mind and thoughts that just come and go, we are not stuck. We are not inside them. We don't need to believe them. They're just phenomena like birds in the sky. And there again, we find ourselves free from the control of these. And the mind is the big controller. I mean, we just think about, you know, how much thought controls us. And yet thought, as you probably see already, is such a mess, is so chaotic. Our mind is like a concert, a music, the Israel Symphony Orchestra, every instrument played by another monkey. That's what it's like. Every instrument is playing chaos. We want to make music, but the mind and all the chaotic thoughts just make crazy sounds and annoying, stupid thoughts and repeating loopim in the brain and kind of destructive thoughts and critical thoughts and stupid thoughts and just wanting things that are impossible and worrying about this and maye and mahaya and just on and on and on and on. And that is us. That's us. It's crazy. From there, we kind of put together me. And it gets very much more crazy and more tragic when we really believe these thoughts. Someone can tell us, you have to go to war to defend democracy. Someone can tell us that. We can believe it. We take the view. And then the whole country goes to war, killing endless people because of a view, a theory, a thought called, we must go to war for democracy. Nagid. Or like Vietnam, we must go to war for freedom. Never mind, we'll kill 3 million Vietnamese for freedom. What does that mean? What's freedom? Who's freedom? What kind of, you know, and it's just an example. I don't want to go into politics, but it's just an example of how a thought, which is just a thought, basically a view, an opinion, and not truth, that is shared by a large number of people, can create so much suffering, because and it's not seen as a view, it's seen as truth. We must go to fight the other side of the world and kill people there because we have a view called freedom. So just as, you know, just a story, some kind of in the Buddhist psychology, thought is one of the senses, like sound. It is not something which is special status, like we want to give it special status, and it's us. But actually, it's just raw material, chomagelim, that arises in the mind, just like a sound, which we're not controlling, arises in the ears. So a thought, which we're also not controlling, arises in the mind. Same. There's an interesting perspective in Buddhist psychology. And in this sense, there's nothing wrong. The mind is just like a mirror, picking up thought, picking up sound, picking up vision. It's a mirror. It's what's coming in? Thought. What's coming in? This. What's coming in? So, like that, we practice with thought. Up to now, and for the moment, it's best for all of you not to bother with thought, to let it go. But I'm just explaining that it's possible to work with thought as a third foundation, work with mind, and we will be working with it later. But for the moment, it's good to work with the first and the second foundation, and not to start working with a third foundation. We're starting to work with it when we're talking about, for example, working with boredom, shi'imum, or working with isheket. This is already working with the third foundation, mind. But we want to build a good foundation of mindfulness before we can really go to work with thought, because it's just that much more difficult, because thought is so dominant and powerful. It's more difficult to see a thought coming and going, because it holds so much of us in it. It carries so much weight. So we do it gradually. But you're all invited. Anyway, when thought arises and passes, to know that fact. Thought is arising and passing. And I'm going back to the breath. Not to stay with thought, but to go back to the breath. But it's helpful to know. Thinking is happening, and now I'm back to the breath. And the fourth foundation is actually the Dhamma itself, or the spiritual teaching itself, as an object of meditation. That means, now this, the Dhamma is a huge, huge teaching. We are just taking a very, very tiny little slice of it, which is practice of mindful awareness, and it's a good place to start. But it's a huge teaching. And working with Dhamma, or the spiritual teaching itself, is about, for example, working with qualities of being, such as love. Love becomes the practice. Love becomes something coming and going. Love becomes we have a dialogue with love. Or we have a dialogue with calmness. Or we have a dialogue with insight. Now more, now less, now this, now that. So that becomes, in a sense, the object of meditation in the fourth foundation. It's the spiritual teachings themselves become our dialogue or our awareness or our relationship with our watching. And so I think I'll stop with this. But just to say, vipassana, in a sense, is not the end of the road. Vipassana allows us to drop the baggage, to drop all the stuff we're holding, to deconstruct this human being that we're so stuck with, me, and I think, and I want, and I feel, and I like, and I don't like, and who I am, and it allows us to cut through all of that with clarity and see that we are how we are constructed. And let it go. And we drop the baggage and we drop the weight. But when we drop that weight of being a kind of a constructed human being called me, we drop that weight, that allows us to jump, that allows us to leap into places that we can't design, into freedom that we cannot construct. But we do need to let go of the constructions before we can jump into freedom. Thank you. So we'll take a few minutes of silence.